human rights. The Palestinians want to be free, just want to be has their freedom.
I want the French government to stop completely cut all ties with Israel. I want the French government to recognize Palestine. I want the French government to stop being hypocrites and actually play a role in making the change.
Harsh words calling for tough actions, which are unlikely to be taken up by the government here. As Israeli artillery continues to pound Gaza and parts of South Lebanon, France says it no longer supplies Israelis with the military equipment being used on those two fronts. The statement met with skepticism by some. The visit of the highly controversial Israeli minister Bezalel Smotrich for a private gala seems set to go ahead, as does a football match later this week between France and Israel.
While sports are often seen as a unifying factor, this match is now under scrutiny as a potential flashpoint of unrest and protest, especially given the current situation in Lebanon and Palestine. Peter Hume at the Stade de France near Paris.
Francesca Albanese, the high-profile UN Special Rapporteur on a tour of British universities, paying a short visit to supporters outside London's Queen Mary University ahead of a speech inside. We asked her what message she had brought to the UK.
The UK is in breach of its international law obligations. It's in good companies because many countries are not abiding by international law right now. Israel is committing a genocide. It's not only me saying that. It's hundreds of legal experts, historians, genocide scholars, including from Israel. There are 30 experts of the United Nations saying that. There is the International Court of Justice recognizing the plausibility of a genocide. Why the UK is still trading weapons with Israel?
As she headed to the venue of her lecture, she was confronted by an Israel supporter who was escorted away by police.
There are two protests taking place, one by a small pro-Israel crowd accusing the UN rapporteur of anti-Semitism, and another one by a pro-Palestinian crowd who say they consider Francesca Albanese as a hero and a champion for human rights.
Since her arrival in the UK, the attacks on Ms. Albanese from pro-Israel groups have been relentless but futile. As the UN Special Rapporteur, Albanese has spent years reminding the world of what international law says about the rights and responsibilities of the occupier and the occupied. Ahead of her visit to the UK, she published a report accusing Israel of committing genocide and apartheid. That drew the wrath of not just Israel, but its main backer, the United States, with outgoing Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield accusing Albanese of anti-Semitism and calling for her dismissal from the UN. Israel's smear campaigns against Albanese predate October 7th. Not one to be silenced, she's gone in the other direction, and by doing so, inspired more global Palestine solidarity. Saeed Bourizab, London.
Russia's banking system connected to Russia's Mir payment network, signaling a new chapter in Tehran-Moscow relations. The announcement made in a ceremony held in the Iranian capital Tehran, attended by the governor of Iran's central bank and the ambassador to Russia. All in line with a common objective, boosting bilateral ties.
As a valuable neighbor, Russia offers great potential for strong transactions, particularly with our shared perspectives on regional and international events. This positive step can foster increased trade and transactions, and aligns with our goal to use national currencies and pursue de-dollarization, in line with other BRICS members.
According to the officials in charge, the project consists of three phases. The first phase enables Iranian citizens to use their bank cards to withdraw cash from Russian ATMs in rubles. In the second phase, Russian citizens will be able to do the same in Iran. And in the third phase, Russian stores will be linked to Iranian POS terminals, while ATMs in Russia equipped with NFC technology will accept bank cards from Iran's Shetab network. As Iran and Russia forge stronger financial ties, their connected banking systems pave the way for smoother trade and transactions, with ongoing negotiations for an alternative payments messaging service aimed to serve as a replacement for the SWIFT banking system. This comes after the agreement to link Russia's Mir payment network to Iran's Shetal banking system was finalized in St. Petersburg in July.
3 years ago, we introduced the notion of integrating Iran's card payment networks with those of other nations, circumventing Western-imposed sanctions. We are delighted that Russia has joined us in this endeavor, as a project initially projected to span a decade was accomplished in a mere year and a half.
Russia launched the Mir payment system in 2017 as an alternative to international financial services such as Visa and MasterCard. Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
These are the local Shia tribesmen from Pakistan's Kurram tribal region protesting against the closure of a key route connecting them with the rest of the country. It has been more than a month since this essential passage was blocked, isolating the Kurram tribal region with Panachinar at its heart. This has triggered a severe humanitarian crisis in the area near the border with Afghanistan. The closure of this essential passage following recent attacks by pro-Takfiri militant groups that had left over 50 Shia Muslims dead has isolated the district, leading to severe shortages of vital medical supplies and essential commodities, halted educational activities, and severely disrupted daily life.
We are in bad situation because the line order situation here has happened more than 2 weeks. The road is closed. The medicine shortage is on a first stage. I kindly request the government institution, please involve in this situation, give a solution, especially for medicine, because the health is more important than everything. The first thing is health.
The road closures and militant attacks have made life unbearable for us. My small shop, which once thrived by selling daily essentials, now stands half empty. Supplies haven't arrived for weeks, and prices for whatever little is available have shot up.
The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan has expressed serious concerns over the humanitarian crisis in Panachinar, urging the government to take immediate action to alleviate the suffering of residents.
The government of Pakistan, along with provincial authorities, must urgently reopen the roads to recover from the humanitarian situation in the region and deploy all available resources to prevent cross-border militant attacks from neighboring Afghanistan to maintain peace in Parachinar.
While assuring that the key route will be reopened soon, authorities have stated that the closure was necessary to prevent militant attacks as the violence was escalating into an ethnic and sectarian conflict.
Panachinar's history is marked by the infiltration of militants that have launched assaults on local Shia communities, resulting in widespread bloodshed. These conflicts have often led to road closures, isolating residents and intensifying their hardships. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Yet another Sunday in Sydney, and once again, crowds fill the streets in a powerful display of solidarity with the people of Palestine and Lebanon. Chants echo through the hearts of the city as demonstrators march, their voices united in support for Palestinian rights. At the gathering, a Palestinian speaker took a moment to thank the Australian people for their relentless support, urging them to keep pushing the movement for justice forward.
Prepare to fight. The Zionist terrorists can't occupy the mind of people, the heart of a people that have dignity and honor and are willing to die for it. And we're
tired. Among the demonstrators are Michael Payne and his sister, a dedicated pair who have been unwavering in their advocacy. As staunch supporters of humanitarian rights, the siblings have rarely missed a Sunday without standing up for the Palestinian cause. The crimes must stop, they say, calling on others to join their fight for a just and humane world.
they're claiming that the criminal has a right to defend itself. Well, that's not correct. The criminal has a right to a defence lawyer. They might have a right to a fair trial or something like that, but they don't have the right to defend themselves against the people they're targeting with their horrendous, heinous crimes. So to me, that's part of the spokespeople from the Western governments that claim this.
It seems very bizarre. We have all these international humanitarian laws, international laws about a nation being able to defend themselves from invasion, and yet what Israel has done is completely invade. They have kept the whole of Gaza a prisoner. 2.3 million people are prisoner.
Protesters from all walks of life have come together, highlighting the universal call for justice. University students in Sydney have been a notable presence, voicing their commitment to human rights and standing in unity with the Palestinian people. For them, this isn't just a moment. It's a movement that demands global attention.
I think the narrative has definitely changed. I mean, Israel has been enacting a kind of slow, creeping genocide for decades and decades. Now it's like accelerated 100 times with what's happening in Gaza. I think definitely it's a genocide, it's ethnic cleansing.
Despite mounting pressure and opposition, pro-Palestine groups in Australia continue to make their voices heard, fighting for their fundamental right to protest. Amid government criticism, these activists hold firm, asserting that the call for freedom and justice cannot be silenced. They emphasize that nations like Australia cannot remain silent. They must take action and hold Israel accountable, rejecting any stance of complicity in the face of injustice.
For people here, this protest isn't just an event. It has turned into a movement for justice, a stand to secure a future rooted in what's right. Shahana Butt, Sydney.
In a heartfelt show of solidarity, Pakistanis have gathered in Islamabad to mark 40 days since the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, the influential Hezbollah leader who was killed by Israeli forces in Lebanon last month. The memorial ceremony drew people from all walks of life, united in honoring Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah's legacy of resistance and condemning the actions of the U.S. and Israel in Gaza.
The silence of those who seek to appease their Western masters, including the U.S. and U.K., has been glaringly exposed during Israel's unrelenting genocide in Gaza. The world will never forget the oppression inflicted by Israel and the United States on the Palestinians, and sooner or later, both will be brought to justice.
The event, held at the heart of the city, served as a reminder of Hassan Nasrullah's influence that transcended borders, resonating deeply with people far beyond Lebanon.
Shahid Hassan Nasrullah.
Nasrullah's life was defined by his commitment to resistance and his people. He was more than just a leader. He was a symbol of defiance against oppression and a beacon for those striving for dignity and justice.
Participants also spoke about the ongoing humanitarian crisis faced by the Palestinians, particularly in Gaza.
The events in Gaza signal that Israel's reckoning is near. The resilience of the people of Gaza and Lebanon proves their promise, choosing death over surrender to an oppressive Zionist entity. The destruction and loss of life do not signify victory for Israel, but mark a defeat for both Israel and the U.S.
The venue was adorned with large framed photographs of martyrs from Gaza and portraits of resistance leaders who had sacrificed their lives fighting against Israeli atrocities. Replicas of children's bodies shrouded in white cloth lay as silent witnesses to the human cost of war and Israeli oppression in Gaza.
The memorial not only honored Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah and other resistance martyrs, but also served as a powerful testament to the shared resilience of those fighting for a future free from violence and oppression. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Thank you.
option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
On Tuesday, after the expiry of a 30-day U.S. deadline for Israel to take steps to address the humanitarian situation in Gaza, Washington said Israel was not blocking aid to Gaza and therefore not violating U.S. law, and that the U.S. will not limit arms transfers to Israel as it had threatened to a month ago if the situation had not improved. That is while relief groups say conditions are worse than at any point in the 13-month-old war, and the global community and the UN itself have firmly condemned the blockade in Gaza as a clear violation of several, and not just one, international humanitarian laws. How could this brutal show of genocide and double standards go on with the international community basically just looking the other way? I am Bahman Roy, and in tonight's episode of Spotlight, we'll get to the bottom of the issue of the US weapons supply to Israel. Allow me to introduce my guests. Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq from Bethlehem, New York. And Daniel Kovalik, human rights lawyer, who is with us from Pittsburgh, Pasadena. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Well, I'm going to start with Scott here. My question for you now is that, well, why did the U.S. even impose the 30-day deadline, you know, to now go through the humiliation of having to deny the obvious violation of laws?
When the United States announces 30-day time period, almost everybody who is knowledgeable of U.S. policy toward Israel and towards Gaza, towards the Palestinians, understood it for what it was, an election gimmick. Kamala Harris, at that time the Democratic Party candidate for president, was looking at electoral problems in swing states such as Michigan, where you had a heavy pro-Palestinian constituency. And so this was a gimmick. This was a ploy for Kamala Harris and the Biden administration to say, look, we care about the Palestinian people. Look what we're doing. But if they cared, they would have given the Israelis a three-day a time period or four-day. But 30 days took them right past the election, which was this was all about. The United States was never, ever going to impose an embargo on weapons sent to Israel. This was purely a political move, and it's exposed the United States and the Biden administration as the hypocrites that they are.
Right. Daniel, you're a human rights lawyer. My question is that, you know, even if the U.S. administration confirmed a breach of the humanitarian law in Gaza, there was no specific, correct me if I'm wrong, there was no specific punitive measure included in the original letter sent to the Israeli government. So was this, could we say, was this just a pre-election PR play by the lame duck Biden government?
Yes, of course. I agree with Scott, who said that, you know, all of us knew that the fact they put the deadline past the election indicated this was a political ploy. In fact, I mean, the truth is, if they wanted to be more politically smart, if they really wanted to win badly enough, they would have cut the aid off before the election, right? To really show their base that was concerned about this issue that they cared, but they don't care. I mean, they couldn't even pretend well enough. The fact they put it beyond the election date was so patently cynical on their part. And that's why they, you know, one of the reasons Kamala lost the election is they could not even with a straight face pretend to do the right thing. By the way, it should be noted they did the same thing with deciding on whether to send long-range missiles to Ukraine. They also set that date for after the election. And again, everyone saw through this cynicism, and that's why they lost as badly as they did.
And Daniel, can you tell me, you know, of course, the number of the lorries entering the region is something absolutely countable. So how could they say that this is not violating the law? Because they clearly said that 350 lorries a day, that was what was needed, actually, to do the humanitarian aid and to cover the entire need. And this is not happening. I think yesterday was just 39 lorries. So how could they just lie to the face of the people like that?
Well, that's what they do. They've been lying about this from the beginning. We know that back in April, Anthony Blinken lied to Congress, saying that Israel was not blocking aid when he was told by two agencies of the United States, USAID and the Refugee Bureau of his own State Department, that Israel was blocking aid. But he lied about it in order to continue sending arms to Israel. The U.S. has been lying about this from the beginning. The U.S. has been lying about Israel and Palestine since 1948, let's face it. And it's shameful, and it has real-world consequences. You know, EuroMed said that now northern Gaza should be declared a famine area. And, you know, so we know aid's not getting in. We know barely any aid's been getting in there for now almost 2 months. And I have friends in Gaza. I know that they're not getting food. They're not getting water. So, but, yeah, the government of the U.S. keeps lying.
Right. Scott, Minister of the new Minister of Military Affairs in Israel, Katz, said that Israel is not going to take its foot off the pedal and is going to go on with the war, and there is going to be no peace deal with Hezbollah or in Gaza. And also we had on the news that they have a plan to stay in Gaza at least until the end of 2025. So this arms sales must go on in order to achieve something like that. Haaretz said that there is a plan to actually make that happen. So could we say that it doesn't really matter who is the president? It's like the arms factories who are making the final decisions on these matters.
Well, it's definitely not the arms factories making the decisions. It's the elected leaders of the United States. But you're right. It doesn't matter who is president because, as we saw in this election cycle, while there were many issues that divided Democrats and MAGA Republicans, they were united on their support for Israel, their unyielding support for Israel. One only has to take a look at the national security picks that Donald Trump has announced as president-elect to understand that his administration will even be more supportive of Israel than the Biden administration. This is, you know, one of the unchanging realities of American politics in recent decades. But it doesn't matter what the American policy is. The fact of the matter is, Israel Katz, the new Minister of Defense, his rhetoric is meaningless. Having a plan that cannot be implemented means you have empty words and nothing more. Israel's in a bind. They may have a plan to see this through 2025. What does that mean? That means that they weren't able to resolve it in 2024. Think about that for a second. They weren't able to resolve this issue in 2024. Israel is not designed to engage in long-term conflicts such as this. So whatever plan they have is a plan they're making up as they go, with no guarantee of success. And indeed, when you look at the myriad of factors out there, a collapsing economy, a society at near civil war tensions, the inability to defeat Hamas, the inability to defeat Hezbollah, Iran able to impose its will, military will on Israel anytime it chooses, I would put money on the fact that the Netanyahu government collapses long before this 2025 plan reaches fruition.
Daniel Anthony Blinken said that Israel, by its own standards, has achieved whatever it had planned to achieve in Gaza. So now would be a really good time to end the war. But what is it that the Israelis are really after, other than an annexation, of course?
Yeah, they want genocide. They want to get rid of the Palestinian people, not just in Gaza, but now in the West Bank. They've made that clear. They want to fully annex the West Bank beginning next year. Of course, they're already killing people in the West Bank. This is about ethnic cleansing and genocide. Murder is the goal. Murder of civilians is the end, and that's what they're doing. And now they're extending that to Lebanon, where they're trying to totally depopulate parts of southern Lebanon. This is a gruesome situation. We know what they intend to do, and it's to wipe out the Palestinian people as a people. That is what genocide is.
And of course, Scott, again, we've been hearing all the international community, many members of the international community, condemning the attacks, the genocide and everything. But what can actually they do in order to stop this? What feasible thing is there for the international community, led by the UN, to actually make a stop, put a stop to this?
Well, the first thing is to turn words into action. sever all diplomatic relations and all economic relations with Israel, declare Israel to be a pariah state, shut down Israeli diplomatic missions across the world, shut down Israeli businesses across the world, and then come together and impose a de facto economic blockade against Israel and back this up with the potential of military force. We're talking about one of the most horrific crimes being committed against all of humanity in modern times, the active ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people. It's high time that the Arab world unite, because there before the grace of God go they. If Israel gets away with this genocide of the Palestinian people and this partial genocide of the Lebanese people, they will take the same template and apply it to Jordan, to Syria, to Iraq, to Iran, to Egypt. And this is the reality. We are not talking about a rational state actor here. We're talking about an irrational apartheid state that treats every non-Jew as a human animal, less than human, therefore justifiable in terms of their slaughter. There is so much the world could do, but they lack the political will to do it.
And another question for you, Scott, again. Tell me something. You know, at the same time, you know, that we are speaking, Israeli are adding to the firepower, you know, getting new planes, getting new, the THAAD system, all sorts of new military equipments. But at the same time, they haven't managed to stop Hezbollah from stopping their attacks. And Hezbollah is actually intensifying its attacks with much more tangible achievements in the region. So how come are they continuing with this ground operations, airstrikes? You know, what will be the end in Lebanon for them?
Well, the end in Lebanon will be defeat. This will be the third time and perhaps maybe the last and decisive time that Hezbollah defeats the Israeli Defense Force or the Israeli Occupation Force, depending on semantics. Hezbollah has been preparing since 2006, the last time Israel and Hezbollah fought a major action against one another for this fight. That's 18 years of preparation. And they are showing this right now. They are fully cognizant of Israel's military capabilities. They have prepared defenses that are able to absorb the Israeli strikes. They have redundancy built in. They have resilience. And it's showing. Hezbollah has not yielded ground in southern Lebanon. They are fighting back and making the Israelis pay an extraordinarily high cost. And as you said, they are now beginning to unleash new weaponry. Israel claimed to have destroyed Lebanon's long-range ballistic missile capabilities. Hezbollah is showing that that is not the case. And the longer this conflict goes on, the more Hezbollah will reveal additional capabilities until all of Israel will be subjected to very accurate strikes by Hezbollah rockets and missiles.
Right. Daniel, I'm now going to go back to the discussion towards the new U.S. administration, because some analysts were hoping that there would be a change of path by the new Donald Trump government. But at the same time, he has already chosen the former Arkansas governor, Mike Huckabee, as the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. Huckabee has a track record, of course, of hardline, occasionally provocative pro-Israeli rhetorics, and previously said Israel has a rightful claim to the West Bank. How do you think this will affect the policies of the new Donald Trump era? You know, because many people are actually thinking that he's going to bring peace.
Yeah, I think any hope about that it has been put to rest by these appointments. Mike Huckabee, for example, you mentioned, is a religious zealot. He is a Christian Zionist who thinks that if Israel takes over Jerusalem and the Dome of the Rock, that he will bring about the end times. This is, he could not have picked a more dangerous person for this job. He's also, Trump is also apparently going to pick Marco Rubio as the Secretary of State, another very zealot Zionist. Apparently his UN ambassador is also going to be a dedicated Zionist. So I have no hope for this administration. In fact, to the extent Trump has said he wants peace in the Middle East, he wants it at the expense of the Palestinians. He says he wants Israel to have a resounding victory. That's what he means by peace, and all that means in reality is slaughter.
And I'm going to use your knowledge as a human rights lawyer, of course, and as a lawyer. Tell me, how can this elusive arms embargo actually be realized against Israel?
Well, that's a great question. The problem we have, of course, is that international law has been destroyed, mostly by the United States. The International Criminal Court, it was threatening to issue arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant. Now you don't even hear about that. They've been intimidated into not doing that. The International Court of Justice has put down a few very good decisions against Israel. None of them have been followed. In fact, Israel has done the exact opposite of what the ICJ has told it to do. I mean, truthfully, the only way for Israel to be made to abide by basic tenets of human rights law and international humanitarian law is for it to be militarily defeated. That's it. I mean, just like the only way to make, you know, the Holocaust end was for the Nazis to be defeated. It's a similar situation.
Thank you. And Scott, recently we've witnessed tensions between the Israeli government and also and France regarding the slightly different position that the France has taken towards the Israeli aggression on Gaza and Lebanon. Do you think this is going to develop into a full divide in the collective West regarding the unconditional support for Israel eventually?
I believe that there will be an additional hardening of the international community's feelings toward Israel. We've already seen that Israel is being identified in many places around the world as a pariah state, a genocidal state, a criminal state. And it's only going to get worse, as Daniel indicated. The Israelis will continue this genocide. Tragically, we're going to see tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of additional Palestinians and Lebanese slaughtered by the Israelis as they continue unchecked in these wars. The only way to bring an end to this fighting is through the military defeat of Israel. But the military defeat of Israel can be assisted and facilitated through meaningful diplomatic intervention. And as nations like France become frustrated with Israel and Israel's actions and the inability and unwillingness of the United States to intervene, I believe you're going to see them take additional actions. I mean, just to give you an example, you could deny American resupply flights overflight rights. You could deny them access to bases on European soil. You could deny ships the ability to dock in ports. There are numerous things that can be done to hamper the American military resupply of Israel. And I think if this wanton murder continues, that we may see some of these actions actually manifest themselves.
Daniel, regarding the unconditional support of the collective West for Israel, we have witnessed a lot of rogue actions towards the international community by the Israeli regime. For example, Mr. Guterres being called persona non grata, or the positions, the stances that the Israeli regime and Netanyahu in particular have taken against all European governments that have kind of tried to criticize their actions in the region. Could we say that this is kind of, this is the European countries, the collective West, has brought it upon themselves because of that unconditional support?
Well, yes, of course. They've turned the other way, as you say, even when they themselves have been attacked. I mean, Israel has been threatening and even attacking UN forces in Lebanon, and some of them are from Europe, of course. I mean, frankly, let's go back to the USS Liberty, which Israel attacked in the 1960s, killed a lot of U.S. servicemen aboard. The U.S. totally swept that situation under the rug. And in fact, the servicemen who survived and have more publicly mourned their comrades have been called anti-Semites because they complained that Israel fired upon a U.S. ship. It's incredible. And you're right. When you give that kind of quarter to a country like Israel, give them that type of impunity, they will take that. They will take that inch and go a mile, and that's exactly what you're seeing.
Thank you. And Scott, my question is now that how do you think the future of this situation is going to unfold? How do you see the future of this?
There are a number of options. One is, will this war escalate further? And what I mean by that, are we going to see Hezbollah and Iran strike Israel in a meaningful fashion? This could change the military and the political dynamic of this conflict considerably. If they choose not to strike, then it's a waiting game. And it's one that I believe Israel will ultimately lose, but one which will be measured tragically in the lives of even more Palestinians and southern Lebanese. I believe that Israel has fatally wounded itself. Its international isolation has led to the collapse of its economy. Internally, the struggles taking place within the Netanyahu government, within Israeli society. I remind people that the Israeli president, even prior to October 7th, 2023, was warning that Israel was very close to civil war. Those conditions still exist to this date. Israel is a very unstable nation, ruled by a man who doesn't care about the survival of Israel, but rather the survival of his political legacy. That is Benjamin Netanyahu. And I see Israel collapsing. Now, this will be good for the Palestinian people in the long term. But as I said, the price that they will have to pay in the interim is unbearable.
Thank you, Scott. And Daniel, the same question to you. How do you think the situation in the region is going to eventually unfold?
Sadly, I see a greater conflagration. You know, Iran recently said that a confrontation with the United States is inevitable now. I think that is correct, again, especially given who Trump's appointments are. I think the world is now bracing for a major conflagration in West Asia. I also agree with Scott. In the long term, I think Israel's doomed. It's doomed itself, but it's going to take a lot of people with it and maybe a lot of nations with it. It's a very terrible situation. We need peace. We need someone in the White House that wants peace, wants to broker peace. Sadly, Trump is not that person.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for your time. It was a pleasure to have you on the program. Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, from Bethlehem Envoy, and Daniel Kovalik, human rights lawyer who joined us from Pittsburgh, Pasadena. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. And that is the end of another Spotlight. Hope to see you tomorrow.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Royal College of Nursing has said health reforms in England have been put at risk with large numbers of nurses quitting the profession. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Increasing number of British-trained nurses are set to leave the profession in England within a decade of registering, in a trend that could jeopardise the government's overhaul of healthcare, according to a union. More than 11,000 nurses will have quit the register within their first 10 years on it, according to analysis by the Royal College of Nursing of the latest official figures. Low staffing levels, increasing patient need, and poor morale were among the factors cited by the largest nursing union, which examined data kept by the Nursing and Midwifery Council, the regulator for nurses and midwives in the United Kingdom, and nursing associates in England. Professor Nicola Ranger, the Royal College of Nursing's General Secretary and Chief Executive, said, "Nursing is an incredible career and it should be one for life, but thousands are quitting early because they are burnt out, underpaid and demoralised. It is a perfect storm for ministers as thousands leave the nursing profession early and student recruitment collapses. It's also a heartbreaking state of affairs for those who want to spend their lives caring for others." Professor Nicholas Ranger said the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, needed to give nurses a reason to stay, and she called for new investment in nursing, better pay, and waiving the loans of those who commit to the career in the National Health Service and public sector. The number of nurses leaving within 10 years of registering increased by 43% between 2021 and 2024, according to the Royal College of Nursing's analysis. Those leaving within 5 years was found to have risen by 67%. Those leaving nursing are a combination of newly qualified nursing staff and experienced staff who had returned from retirement during the pandemic. The Royal College of Nursing's own survey of those departing found that nurses cited poor physical and mental health, burnout or exhaustion, and changes in personal circumstances as key reasons for leaving the profession outside retirement. The concerns were raised after the government last month launched a consultation on its 10-year plan to transform the National Health Service, which includes a long-term workforce plan intended to increase the number of nurses from about 350,000 to 550,000 by 2036-2037. The plan, which is to be published next year, is intended to be underpinned by three big themes. 1. Shift from hospital to community care with new neighbourhood health centres, digitisation and sickness prevention. Separately, the government has been targeting the hospital backlog in England with plans to increase the number of appointments and operations each week by 40,000. Labour made a pledge before the general election that a target to start treatment within 18 weeks for most National Health Service patients in England would be hit within 5 years. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, also pledged whilst in opposition that Labour would oversee the biggest expansion of National Health Service staff in history, and that they would be told to work on evenings and weekends to help cut back waiting times. The government faces other wins aside from nurses leaving the workforce. In September, nurses in England rejected the 5.5% pay rise they were given for this year. The Royal College of Nursing says the value of experienced nurses' pay dropped by 25% under the various Conservative governments between 2010 and 2024. The number of people studying to become nurses has fallen substantially across England, according to analysis released last month by the Royal College of Nursing, with some areas recording a 40% drop in successful applications. The Department of Health and Social Care has said the National Health Service has faced chronic workforce shortages for years and that bringing the necessary staff to build a healthcare service for the future will take time. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Social Care said this government has inherited a workforce that has been undervalued for years, leaving them burnt out and demoralised. That's why we accepted the recommendations of the independent pay review bodies to award National Health Service staff with an above-inflation pay rise. It will take time, but together we will recover and rebuild our National Health Service so it's a service staff can be proud of to work in once again. The website of the Royal College of Nursing, Britain's biggest nursing union, has also covered the same story and tells us more. A huge increase in nursing staff quitting the profession early will make government National Health Service reforms impossible to deliver, according to a new analysis from nursing union and profession colleges. The analysis shows that thousands of UK-educated nurses are walking away within 10 years of the first registering due to burnout and exhaustion brought on by low staffing levels, increasing patient need and a lack of recognition from government. The Royal College of Nursing is warning ministers that they face a perfect storm of more staff leaving and fewer joining the profession, threatening patient care. By the end of the next parliament, more than 11,000 nurses will have quit the Nursing and Midwifery Council register within the first 10 years of gaining their registration, equivalent to the entire district nurse, health visitor and school nurse workforce in England. The Royal College of Nursing analysed the latest Nursing and Midwifery Council data of UK-educated nursing staff leaving the register in England. Between 2021 and 2024, the numbers leaving within 10 years of registering increased by 43%, whilst those leaving within 5 years rose by a staggering 67%. According to the Nursing and Midwifery Council's Leaver survey, nursing staff cite poor physical and mental health, burnout and exhaustion, and changes in personal circumstances as key reasons for leaving the nursing profession early. Those leaving are a combination of newly qualified nursing staff quitting the profession and experienced staff who had returned from retirement during the pandemic. The government is planning to modernise the National Health Service and shift care into the community, requiring tens of thousands of additional nurses working in local communities outside of hospitals. However, by 2036-2037, the estimated shortfall in community nurses is expected to be 37,000. The Royal College of Nursing says its analysis shows that without intervention, this figure is likely to rise. The Leaver figures follow recent Royal College of Nursing analysis of universities and colleges admission service, which shows that a collapse in every region in England in the number of people studying to become nurses. Staff quitting early also has a cost to government and employers, including on initial down payments on student fees, support for clinical placements, recruitment costs into the service, and professional development whilst enrolled. The Royal College of Nursing says the government must take two approaches: substantially raising pay levels to make nursing more attractive, whilst agreeing to waive the graduate loans for nurses who agree to stay working in the National Health Service and the public sector. This would boost recruitment retention and ease staffing shortages. Across England's National Health Service alone, there are over 32,000 unfilled nursing posts. Since 2010-2011, the pay of the average nurse has fallen by 23% in real terms. The Royal College of Nursing's General Secretary and Chief Executive, Professor Nicola Ranger, said, "Nursing is an incredible career. It should be one for life, but thousands of people are quitting early because they're burnt out, underpaid and demoralised. It is a perfect storm for ministers as thousands leave the profession early and student recruitment collapses. It's also a heartbreaking state of affairs for those who want to spend their lives caring for others."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the Israeli regime is leading a large-scale campaign of ethnic cleansing in the occupied East Al-Quds. Two Palestinian prisoners have lost their lives in Israeli custody due to what rights groups call slow death policy of the regime. And the United Nations has called on Israel to allow it an unrestricted access to the Gaza Strip in order to deliver humanitarian aid to the besieged territory.